I'm delighted now to welcome Dennis Tedlock. He is a professor of English and Anthropology at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He's a world-renowned Mayan authority. He's a native New Mexican, and his new book is called 2,000 Years of Mayan Literature. Welcome, Dennis, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So 2,000 years of Mayan literature. I suspect that many of our listeners didn't even know there was ancient or millennia-old Mayan literature, but they have a literary tradition spanning back far further than European contacts.
Yes, we don't know what the earliest texts might turn out to be, but right now we have two that are 400 BC, and the English language didn't even exist then, and the English didn't know how to write then either.
So, what was the nature of this oldest 400 BC literature, and what form did it survive?
It survives. Most of it was probably written on paper by the time we get around to 500-600 AD. But it survives in inscriptions that were painted on pottery, carvings on stone. It's not like Egypt, you know, where paper stayed around for thousands of years, and people still find it. All the paper went there, but they wrote almost everything on paper. So we've got just a bit of that. So we have this picture that's dependent on those, on the pottery and on the stone carvings.
So they had paper, and as you write, they had books. Although many of those books were burned during the Spanish period.
Yes, although the Spanish didn't do quite as good a job as everyone thought. They were still finding and confiscating books all the way into about the middle of the 17th century, so it wasn't like the Spanish swept in and overnight turned everything upside down. But through all of that, we just have parts of four books. But the old paintings have pictures of people writing in books, so it goes back a long way.
Do we have any sense of how widespread literacy was?
That's a good question, and a hard one to answer. There's a lot of graffiti. Some of those sites where all the rooms are plastered with stucco, there's a lot of carved graffiti on the walls. And it looks like quite a few people knew how to write dates from the Maya calendar, but maybe not much else. But every now and then there's, especially in pilgrimage sites like caves, people wrote long things. But maybe the most unusual thing about the literacy was that it was, it seems like a lot of the people who were literate were members of royal courts. So it's not like the Middle East, where the people who wrote were all sort of craftspeople, bureaucratic employees and so on, and the nobility didn't dirty their hands. The Mayan nobility dirtied their hands with ink, unlike even, say, 5th century Athens. Really high-class people didn't know how to write. They got your hands dirty.
One thing that you do in this book, 2,000 Years of Mayan Literature, which I found very interesting, is you talk about the process of learning to decipher the Mayan language and the mental blocks that Western readers, scholars had to overcome in order to read what was in front of them.
Yeah, the early missionaries who saw the writing, just one of whom really made a serious effort to try to figure out how it worked. They were kind of broad-minded in a certain way. They thought it must be somebody else's alphabet. So they said, you know, write me your sign for A, B, C, and so on like that in Spanish. And they didn't realize the answers they got were the syllables, B, C. They didn't ask for Ba, B, B, Bu, Bo, Bu. They just asked for B, because that's Spanish word for the letter B. And so on. If it had been an Englishman doing it, the results would have been a little different. The next group of people, so when we get up to when scholars get interested in this beginning in the 19th century, really, Here was a group of people who desperately wanted it not to be an alphabet. They still had a mistaken idea that Chinese writing, ancient Egyptian writing before it was deciphered, they wanted it to be the opposite of the alphabet. They wanted it to be free of language. They wanted it to communicate ideas directly through pictures and diagrams instead of being a sound notation. So they made the opposite mistake. And so it wasn't until the middle of the 20th century that it was figured out that, like, by that time people knew how Chinese really worked. It's full of sound notation. Mayan is another mixed writing system where some of the signs are keyed right to the syllables of words, but they also threw in a lot of signs that stand for whole words instead of spelling everything out. So the experience of reading that, you have to kind of bounce back and forth. Am I supposed to look at this one as a whole word or as something being spelled here? And the neat thing about these mixed writing systems is there's more than one way to write anything. There's no correct spelling. You can spell creatively.
And so some of the, it's what you call a composite system, and so some of them are almost little pictures of ideas, but
right.
You can't get stuck thinking that the whole language is like that. I mean, I was looking at, the book is very fully illustrated, and some of what turn out to be poems that are on the rims of, for example, a vase, to the untrained eye, would look like purely decorative art.
That's true. And in fact, on some of the vase inscriptions, say as late as the 1950s, there were some people who just said those were meaningless. They were just a traditional way of decorating the room. And in fact, they're dedications. They tell you who the vase was painted for, and in some cases, who painted it.
And so this is really a field that is very much alive, because there is so much work. I mean, if the deciphering was that recent, then there's so much work for scholars to do in simply reading, not to mention finding the meaning of all these artifacts.
Yes, and the process of decipherment is still going on. We don't know what each and every sign might be, and we probably never will, but we know enough to where you can reconstruct what part of it means because of what fits the whole story that's being told or the poem that's being set out. So people who are focused on the nitty-gritty of decipherment will still make important contributions, but we're now in a stage where we can read a whole text and get we can see the forest and not just the trees. And that's the kind of move that's involved in this book.
The focus of this book is in the title, 2,000 Years of Mayan Literature. We're talking, by the way, to the author of this book, Dennis Tedlock. So treating this work as literature and not just as, I shouldn't say just, but not as linguistics and anthropology and history and so on, is a new way of looking at this work.
Yeah, for example, once it was realized, a lot of the inscriptions are describe events in the lives of real people who were born on such and such a date, who got married on such and such a date, became the lord of some city at such and such a date, and then died, and other things that happened. So the immediate reaction to that was to try to compile all of it and create a linear history. And that's a useful way of finding out certain things, but that's not how the Mayans wrote history. They have a lot of flash forwards and flashbacks. They were bored with just listing events in the exact order in which they occurred. Since they had a calendar and could cite the dates, that frees you up, and so you can say, and before that happened, 40 years before that happened, this happened. And so forth. And then they interwove all those human stories with the story of what the moon, stars, sun, planets were doing. So there's this kind of astrological aspect to the texts. And once once people discovered the history was there, the history of real people, they started to ignore the astronomical, astrological stuff. So you have a whole generation of people who don't understand the astronomy in the texts. So I'm trying to put the two strands back together. Because all of these people who had their life, these events inscribed on these monuments and tablets and things, were trying to characterize, trying to, you know, give a deeper meaning to the events in their lives by relating them to what was happening in the heavens.
So really, you need one to understand the other, because in their view, they were connected.
Yes, yes. So I like to take a Mayan view of history and not just reconstruct all that history from, you know, the way a European would do it.
Well, that's a big difference. Can you explain to us what that difference is? In other words, how, for you, Dennis Tedlock, who have lived in Guatemala and become deeply involved in the culture in the way that even a lot of scholars have not, what is the difference, for example, of the Mayan way of approaching these texts than the European way?
Well, there's the business of all the flashbacks and flash forwards. What they're doing when they do that is to try to find a resonance in events to compare them, to point to things that happen different times and places have in common. And then how somehow that reflects the poetry they saw in the movement of the moon and planets. You know, whereas somebody who's just trying to reconstruct a lineal history just ignores all of that stuff and looks at the birth, death, accession to the throne kinds of stuff, or who made war on whom, and all the rest of that. So the other thing is that's harder to reconstruct is Mayan poetry is built on parallelism. So they state everything in two or three different ways, one after the other. You wouldn't just say mention the Sangre de Cristos. You would mention them together with some other mountain range, or mention them together with a canyon for the contrast and so on. They're always building these pairs of things. Again, that's all irrelevant if you're just looking for information in the texts instead of listening to the poetry. But what makes it a little hard in the hieroglyphic texts is that they assumed that the reader would know how that went. So they sometimes kind of tightened things up, especially if they were chopping all this into a block of stone, so that they're assuming a reader who knows what the rest of the poetry would have looked like. So sometimes you just get a kind of a condensed version. So I've tried to unpack that a little bit too, to show what, not only what's in the stone, but what somebody at that time would have said reading it aloud. And I'm sure they wouldn't have just, you know, been like a grade school kid who's being monitored to make sure they read exactly what's on the page. If they were really poets, orators, they would have expanded on what they saw.
We're talking to Dennis Tedlock about the book 2,000 Years of Mayan Literature. Well, that's another question that I wanted to ask you about is, do you have any sense of what the context would be, or what the activity of reading these stories aloud might have been? In other words, they survived as a writing system, but were they part of a storytelling tradition that we know about?
We have, there are a couple of examples of art in the book where you have two people performing before an audience, one of whom seems to be the book person. In fact, sometimes Ahun, the name for that person, the term for that person that means exactly book, person whose profession is paper or book. And then there's another person called the Chilam, which means the spokesman. Now, the pictures make it clear that they both spoke, but I'm suspecting that the book person stuck pretty close to the text and was more like a scholar, and then the spokesman was the person who turned it into a real performance, an oral performance, for an audience. So you get there's some evidence of a kind of a two-stage thing going from a book to talking to an audience. The other thing that's interesting about that is that, and that's been neglected too, the importance of the oral side that would have gone, that goes alongside any writing system actually. The Spanish not only tried to confiscate and destroy all the books, but they banned public performances of Mayan verbal art. They were substituting medieval vernacular theater and, you know, trying to replace all the Mayan stuff with stuff they brought from Europe. So the Mayans at that time had to do all the really artistic performance kind of stuff in private. Couldn't be done in public.
And so they, as a way of continuing their traditions, they did it in private and hopefully undetected by the Spanish and passed it down through generations. Does some version of that survive in contemporary culture?
Well, the verbal art is alive and well. There are also increasing numbers of Mayan writers writing in their own languages, but the oral performance tradition is terrifically alive in Yucatan and Chiapas and Guatemala, Belize. Especially, that there are professional orators in all those towns who do all the oratory at weddings, who can be hired, if you feel inarticulate, who can amplify your prayers for you. If you want to make some prayers, you can hire them to be more eloquent and to kind of plug all your desires into this performance of theirs. And so working with people like that is, as I did, usually they're diviners too. They do things by the Maya calendar and interpret the meanings of the possibilities of future events looking at the calendar. Those, by looking at how those people perform, that's another way you can reconstruct how these ancient texts would have sounded if somebody was standing there telling an audience, you know, expounding on an inscription.
The texts that you have and that are in this book, do you know, or does one know who wrote them? Are there individual writers? Mm. Are they collective?
Some of them are signed. And whenever they're signed, it turns out to be some member of a royal household. And it looks like people who were not in line for the throne, you know, like a son who was second or third or fourth down the line, and women, and this is important, one of the things they could do with themselves is to take up writing and reading. And painting went along with that, too. All the visual arts were packed in together. Anybody who was a writer was also a painter. Anybody who was a painter probably knew how to write. You get that kind of a picture. And the paintings on vases show some of these scenes, which are clearly taking place in court settings where people are working on books or talking to each other about books and so on. What that doesn't tell us is, what about all those things that weren't signed? And the archaeologists are putting out the story that all the literate people were royal. Well, I don't think so. I think it's probably more like only people who had royal pedigrees were allowed to sign their work.
So people with royal pedigrees might have signed work done by somebody else?
Oh, that's possible too, yeah. Nobody's pondered that question, but it's a perfectly good one.
You lived in Guatemala and have, as we were starting to talk about before, a close connection to that culture. Tell us more about your time there and how it changed you and gave you the eyes to see that you have to do a book like this.
Well, Barbara Tedlock and I went down there we ended up studying with diviners, as I said, in a town called Momostenango. And we didn't realize at first that they were studying us and wondering why we kept showing up, taking an interest in sacred places and figuring out what people were doing and how it correlated with, you know, holy days on the Maya calendar and so on. And eventually they drew us in. We asked a lot of questions of diviners who are really at the very center of preserving the traditional culture. And eventually they kind of, when we asked the question about, well, then how do you train people, train and initiate people? They said, well, the main person we worked with, he and his wife actually told us, well, let's, for example, if we were to train you, we would have to begin on this date, and it could be done in this many months, so it would last until here, and they were pointing at a calendar and so on. And we wondered afterwards, were they just using that as an example, or was that an invitation? So we came back the next day and said, when you talked about the calendar and beginning on this date, beginning on that date, were you saying that you'd be willing to instruct us? And they laughed and said, you know, as if to say, we thought you'd never get it. Well, of course. So we actually undertook 4.5 months of formal training. We were double timing. You're supposed to do it in 9 months, but they thought we were quick learners, so they doubled up the number of things that had to be done over a 4.5 months period.
Which is extraordinary because you were working in a language, though, which, although you spoke, it was not your native language.
Right. Well, of course, to help us, we wrote down a lot of things. We made, you know, tape recordings and so forth. And we kind of overdid it. Because when we went to the public initiation, we discovered we were way overprepared. Like, you know, certain kinds of students, so.
You have some amazing stories that are very primal and that are very, very readable to the contemporary reader. Could you read a piece?
Sure. Is there something in particular?
Let's see. Well, there was one about the maiden who is pregnant and
who tricks her mother-in-law?
Yes.
That's good. So, I'll introduce it this way. This woman is the daughter of one of the lords of the underworld, the lords of death. Her father is called Blood Gatherer. Blood Gatherer is still around. The Mayas still in Guatemala still talk about him. He's the one who gathers all the blood, that human blood, that's spilled in violence in the world. Whether by accident or on purpose, war, you know, murder, etc. That's her daddy. And there's the Lords of Death cut off the head of a hero named Seven Death, after a day named Death, combined with the number seven. And they stick it in a tree, and it becomes a tree that the fruit, it's a calabash tree, the fruit looks like skulls. And she hears about it. She wants to go and see it, even though she's not supposed to. And the tree spits in her hand, and she becomes pregnant with the hero twins who will avenge their father's death and set up the motions of the sun, moon, and not the moon. She is the moon. Her name means Blood Moon. It's a pun between the word for moon and the word for blood. So there she is, and she's pregnant, and she manages to escape her own father's death sentence by trickery. She's a woman trickster. That's pretty rare. And you know, there are all these books about the trickster, and Jungian psychologists talk about the trickster, but they never talk about a woman in that role. This woman lives by her wits. She tricks her father and manages to escape from the underworld. Then she comes to her, to the woman who's the mother of this person who died and whose head was in the tree. And Blood Moon came to the mother of one monkey, one artisan, when her children were still in her belly, but it wasn't very long before the birth of Nafpu, Shpalanke is their name. Those are the hero twins. And when the woman came to the grandmother, the woman said to her, "I've come, my lady. I'm your daughter-in-law. I'm your child, my lady," she said when she came here to the grandmother. "Where do you come from? As for my little babies, didn't they die in Shibalba, the underworld? And these two remain as their sign and their word. One monkey and one artisan are their names." Those are the half-brothers of these twins. "Wherever you've come from, get out of here," the maiden was told by the grandmother. "Even so, I really am your daughter-in-law, and I have been for some time. What I carry belongs to one Hunakpu. They are alive. There was no death for one Hunakpu, seven Hunakpu. They have merely made a way for the light to show itself, my mother-in-law, as you will see when you look at the faces of what I carry," the grandmother was told. And then the grandmother said, "I don't want you as my daughter-in-law. It's just a bastard in your belly, you trickster. The children of mine who were named by you are dead," said the grandmother. "Truly, what I say to you is so. Very well. You are my daughter-in-law. I hear you. So get going. Go get their food so they can eat. Go pick a big netful of ripe corn and come back. Since you are already my daughter-in-law, as I understand you," the maiden was told. "Very well," she replied. And so she went to the garden. It was the garden of one monkey and one artisan, the patron deities of writing, by the way. A path had been cleared by them, so the maiden followed it, and she arrived there in the garden. But there was only one clump. There was no other plant there, no second or third. And that one clump had borne its ears. So then the maiden's heart stopped. "It looks like I'm a sinner. I'm a debtor. Where will I get a net full of food?" And then the guardians of food were called upon by her. "Quick, rise up. Quick, stand up. Thunder Woman, Yellow Woman, Cacao Woman, and Cornmeal Woman, keepers of the food of one monkey, one artisan," said the maiden. And then she took hold of the silk, the bunch of silk at the top of the ear. She pulled it straight out. She didn't pick the ear, and the ear reproduced itself to make food for the net. It filled the big bag. And then the maiden came back, but animals carried her net. When she got back, she went to put the pack frame in the corner of the house so it would look to the grandmother as if she'd arrived with a load. And then, when the grandmother saw the food, a big net full, "Where did that food of yours come from? You must have leveled the place. Have you brought back our whole garden? I'm going to go see," said the grandmother. And then she went off. She went to look at the garden, but the one clump was still there, and it was clear that the net had been placed at the foot of it. And the grandmother came back in a hurry. She got back home. She said to the maiden, "The sign is still there. You really are my daughter-in-law. I'll have to keep watching what you do. These grandchildren of mine are already showing genius," she told the maiden. Now, the reason for the net, why she read it that way, is the word for net is cut. And that's the name of a day, and that's the day on which Venus was due next to reappear as the morning star. So she looks and says, these really are my grandchildren, and they're going to bring the morning star back.
We're talking to Dennis Tedlock, about the book 2,000 Years of Mayan Literature. Now, you are going to be speaking this Saturday, the 9th of January, from 4 to 6 at Garcia Street Books, and there's going to be an exhibition of fine prints that you designed and that are related to the book. Tell us about these visual images.
Well, some of them are based on the hieroglyphs, and some of them have facsimiles of these alphabetic manuscripts that the Mayans produced during the colonial period. And I chose to, in the book too, to use, wherever possible, the manuscripts themselves rather than transcribe them, because among other things, you get a sense of the antiquity of these pages. But also to make the point that, I mean, one of the real shockers of colonialism, I mean, we never cease to learn more about it. Mayans didn't get access to the printing press as an instrument for publishing their own writing in their own languages until the 1980s. So, and that goes beyond this book. There, I have a final chapter that talks about developments. It's called the Mayan Cultural Renaissance that's going on right now. Now they do have access to the printing press. There's a major publishing house in Guatemala City that's owned and run by Mayans, for example. But that's all very recent. There are literary magazines in Chiapas and Yucatan and so forth. So
in Mayan language?
Yeah.
Do they use... what kind of alphabet do they use?
The Roman alphabet is adapted to Mayan languages. But they have, just like North American indigenous people, they've kind of rejected the spelling choices the missionaries made and revised the way the alphabet is used to represent their languages. But it is alphabetic. That publishing house in Guatemala City, though, Cholsamach it's called, they put the dates of... they give the Mayan dates for all the publication dates of their books, and there are, in Yucatan and in Guatemala, there are workshops where Mayans can go and learn the hieroglyphic writing system. There's not a lot of publication in that way yet, but that's all a very recent development and very much underway right now.
Dennis Tedlock is professor of English and anthropology at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He's a world-renowned Mayan authority, and his new book is called 2,000 Years of Mayan Literature. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be here.